Before we move on to this afternoon's topic, any questions from discussion group anyone would like to bring up? The genuine happiness is a state of inner well-being that results from eliminating the mental afflictions from our mind. Yes. The difference between Vajrayana and Theravada. Right, yeah. So, as I mentioned this morning, a little bit the background for the motivation is their underlying philosophy that they follow. And again, in the Theravada, it's generally accepted that when someone achieves liberation and achieves nirvana, and then that life finishes, then everything's finished. So to develop the aspiration to liberate everyone from suffering would be not, it'd be illogical to develop that, because there's no hope of doing that. So it really never comes up. But of course, as I mentioned, even in Theravada, if we are selfish to the point of putting ourselves ahead of others, we're not ever going to get anywhere near nirvana with that attitude. So also in the foundation level of Theravada, we are cultivating loving kindness and compassion to all living beings, and we're trying to help all living beings as much as we can while we're striving for nirvana, and after we've achieved nirvana we are helping others as much as we can, with the understanding that how much we can help is limited, because at the end of that life, that's it, finished.
For once, yeah. Can I decide that I want to be enlightened?
Again, within Theravada, with the philosophical background, there's not really a distinction between nirvana and enlightenment. Both are just liberation from samsara. So there's not really like one is the next step in Theravada. In Mahayana, there is a clear distinction, and that nirvana is a stepping stone to enlightenment. So the Mahayana assertion is that even if we began with a motivation of merely nirvana and we achieve that goal, then we will, after achieving that goal, come to understand that's not the final goal, and we will go on to cultivate bodhicitta and go on to achieve enlightenment. So this is the Mahayana assertion. Any other questions? Yeah.
The idea of stopping the samsara, like not to become...
To get out of samsara, yeah.
Why is it good? Like, life can be good, and why don't we want to...
You want life to be good, yeah?
Life is good.
Right. Would you like it to be better?
Yeah.
This is the best level of want of it being good. Remember, when we achieve nirvana, we don't sort of disappear in a puff of smoke and end up somewhere else. We're still right here. The difference being is we have no suffering, and we enjoy life much more than we enjoy it now.
But when we will die,
right?
Get a new life.
We'll come back in this world, but not in samsara. So again, the Theravada assertion is that if we achieve nirvana and then this body finishes, end of story, we'll never come back. But from a Mahayana perspective, this is illogical. So Mahayana says that when we achieve nirvana or we achieve enlightenment, we'll keep coming back again and again forever. No suffering, helping everyone else to be liberated. So nirvana is not a way of escaping from this world. It's a way of getting out of suffering and being in this world to help others more.
I understand the difference between the Theravada and Mahayana and the reincarnation, but
sure.
About the practices itself.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I'm understanding, like, the and the six perfections and the three higher trainings,
mm-hmm.
where generosity, patience, and joyous effort, if they're not a part of ethics, or are they, or... Like, someone who, in Theravada, generosity is not that important. It is.
But, of course it is.
But it's not part of the practice, so why is it like that?
It's the main focus. In the Theravada, the main focus is our own liberation from suffering. So therefore, the practices there are really directing towards that. In the Mahayana, the focus is to achieve enlightenment to help others. So therefore, we have things like generosity is more relevant. Of course, we need to be generous in Theravada and be patient and all that.
It's not the main...
The main things that are focused on to help us to achieve that particular goal. I mean, of course, all of the... And also the Theravada, the Eightfold Path, all of those things, right? Livelihood and that. Of course we need that in Mahayana. Of course. It's just a matter of what's emphasized.
What's the main... the goal.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's all.
Can you just speak to the root of the difference? Why is it that the Theravada believes in the Nirvana and then you don't...
Again, it's based on the philosophical understanding of what the Buddha taught. Buddha taught many things to many people, different things. And out of that, what we find is, in ancient India, four main philosophical systems arising due to these various teachings. And the first two philosophical systems draw this conclusion from all the Buddha's teachings, is that when we achieve nirvana, because nirvana is this extinguishment of being reborn, and that's interpreted meaning there's nothing more, that there's no more rebirth, in fact there's nothing more. So it's just really coming from the philosophical understanding.
So it's really about the interpretation of the Buddha's direction.
And of course, the bottom line is, whatever is the case, we will come to see, you know. I mean, if there's two philosophical systems that disagree, if we follow the path, we will, from our own direct experience, come to see what is the true actuality, of course.
But in that sense, the Dalai Lama should know by now.
What's that?
He died, he got rebirth.
In fact, that's what he says. Sure. And in fact, that's what the Dalai Lama often says. He says, when he's commenting on this idea that when achieving nirvana and the body finishes and that's end of story, he said, if it's like that, I don't know if I'd like to achieve nirvana. That's what he says.
Isn't in Theravada we have right action?
Right action.
So isn't generosity also part of action?
Sure. I mean... Yeah, of course. And like I said, all of these need to be practiced. It's just a matter of which ones are emphasized due to the nature of the goal that they're trying to reach. That's all. Of course, you're right.
Can you answer the third question about the order of the third axis?
Okay. Did anyone have any answer? Anyone? Yep, okay.
We thought that... maybe because the order is from the easiest to the hardest.
Very good. Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Very good. And also, on top of that as well, not only is it from easiest to more difficult, each one is the basis for the next. The more you're generous, the easier it becomes to be ethical. The more ethical you are, the easier to be patient. The more patient you are, the more it is to be joyful. And the more joyful you are in your practice, the easier it is to concentrate. And the better you're at concentration, the better wisdom you'll be able to cultivate. So each one is also a sort of platform for the next, but also from easier to more difficult as well. Very good. Okay, let's move on to this afternoon's topic. But actually, we have one thing left over from this morning. So this morning, of course, we're looking at the compassion wing of practice. And at the foundation level, the compassion wing comprises these four immeasurables: loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity. And each one of these four immeasurables has what's called a near enemy. And a near enemy is something that seems to be that quality, but actually is opposite to it. And we've already talked about one of those. And that is, the near enemy of loving kindness is attachment. Attachment seems to be loving kindness, but actually it's the opposite. It interferes and causes problems with loving kindness. Now, fortunately, each one of these four immeasurables can help to overcome the near enemy of one of the other four immeasurables. So they can work together. So if we find that our loving kindness is degenerating into attachment, it's very good to reflect on equanimity. So if we're starting to have attachment instead of loving kindness, then reflecting on equanimity can help us to overcome that attachment. Because remember, equanimity is overcoming attachment to friends, apathy to strangers, and aversion to difficult people. So we can reflect on equanimity to help overcome attachment here. But also, equanimity has a near enemy, something that seems to be equanimity but is actually opposite. And I mentioned that briefly this morning, that this equanimity is this unbiased, impartial attitude towards others. But what can seem like equanimity is that we have this impartial, equal indifference to everyone. So that can seem like equanimity because we're equally indifferent to everyone. But of course, that's not what we're talking about with equanimity. So if we see equanimity degenerating into simply being equally indifferent to everyone, then what can help remedy that is to reflect on compassion. Because it's hard to remain indifferent to people when we observe their suffering. But also, compassion has a near enemy. And that is, often when we are focusing, of course, on others' suffering, then, and connecting with that, instead of compassion, we can just have this sense of overwhelm, this sense of despair. So our compassion can degenerate into just desperation, this sense of despair. And so if we see our compassion degenerating into despair, what can help overcome that is empathetic joy, to focus on the positives. to focus on the ourselves and others, the virtue and good fortune of ourselves and others. Empathetic joy also has a near enemy. So this is a rejoicing in our own and others' virtues, good fortune. But this rejoicing can become meaningless, or we can rejoice in things that are not very meaningful. So it can become what's called very frivolous. We're rejoicing in stuff that's not meaningful. And sometimes we can even start rejoicing when we see other people suffer. You know, in German, I think Schadenfreude it's called. To rejoice in negative. So when we see our rejoicing heading in that direction, then how to overcome that is to reflect on loving kindness in terms of wishing others to have genuine happiness in its causes. Then we can really rejoice in meaningful things instead of meaningless or even harmful things. So each one can help overcome the near enemy of one of the other four immeasurables.
What's the last
one? Frivolous. Frivolous means meaningless. Meaningless rejoicing. What I'd like to do now is still talk about the compassion wing, but now talk about how in the Mahayana we build on the four immeasurables. And so in the Mahayana, the compassion wing is really cultivating this aspiration of bodhicitta, the aspiration for enlightenment for the benefit of others. Now, historically, there were two main methods taught in ancient India and Tibet on how to cultivate this aspiration of bodhicitta. How do we develop that? And I'll mention both of them briefly, and then I want to focus on the second one, the second method. Historically, the first method was the one that was mostly taught and practiced. But as we're going to see, I think the first method potentially has some points in it that maybe makes it difficult to implement this approach in our modern society. So let's briefly look at the first method. So the first method and the main method to cultivate bodhicitta that was taught in ancient India and Tibet was called the seven cause and effect method. So as the name suggests, seven steps. And the first step is it's the method to help us to develop, cultivate bodhicitta, the aspiration for enlightenment, for the welfare of others. The first step is seeing everyone as our mother. Now, of course, to be able to do this, the logic in this step is that in this life we have a mother, the previous life we had a mother, and we keep going back in that way, and through using that line of reasoning, we can understand everyone has been our mother at some point. So, of course, to have that line of reasoning, we have to have a belief in rebirth. So if we don't have a belief in rebirth, this becomes difficult to have to actually logically have this first step. And also, of course, the reasoning to see everyone as our mother is that historically, at least, the mother was the person who benefited us most in our life. Again, unfortunately, in our modern society, many people have issues with their mother. And so if we see everyone as our mother, we may start hating everybody. So then the text says, if that's the case, you can replace it by father, brother, sister, teacher, some other person. Partner, whatever. Whatever you want to put there. Again, the idea is that everyone's been every relationship to us, but the idea is to put here the person who's benefited us most in our life. And then by understanding that, everyone has benefited us a lot at some point. That's the idea behind the first step. So again, if we don't have a belief in rebirth, this becomes difficult. But I'll briefly go through the seven steps anyway, just to let you know what the seven steps are. The second step is remembering their kindness, to reflect on how kind they were. For example, they carried us in the womb for 9 months. They gave birth to us. They fed us, protected us, clothed us, looked after us, helped us in our education at school and so forth. So if we reflect on how kind they were to us, then we can move to the third step, and that is cultivating a wish to repay their kindness. And if we can really have this wish to repay Mother Sentient Being's kindness, then we can easily develop the fourth and fifth step, which are great love or great loving kindness and great compassion. So here this word great implies not just wishing mother sentient beings to be happy and wishing them to be free of suffering, but actively doing whatever we can to help alleviate the suffering of mother sentient beings and doing whatever we can to bring them to happiness. So that's what the word great is adding, not just wishing, but doing whatever we can to help them to achieve that goal. Once we can develop this great loving kindness and compassion for mother sentient beings, we can start to cultivate the sixth step. Is what's often translated as altruistic intention. And that is to make it our personal responsibility to help liberate all mother sentient beings from suffering. So here we are taking personal responsibility. I myself alone am going to help liberate all mother sentient beings from suffering. This is huge. But of course, when we develop this intention to take personal responsibility to do that, we can look at ourselves and go, well, what can I do now? I can't do much to help mother sentient beings. I've got my own issues. So then we can understand, how can I best, most effectively help to liberate others from suffering? If I myself achieve full awakening. So that, of course, is bodhicitta. So then we would develop that aspiration to achieve enlightenment so that we can enact that intention, that we can really help to liberate others from suffering. So these is the seven cause and effect method, the one that was most widely taught in India and Tibet. Any questions about any of those steps?
Can you understand the difference between the sixth one and the fourth and fifth? And they're all about wishing and doing something for others.
So this, loving kindness and compassion is just the aspiration.
great loving kindness, great compassion is the aspiration plus actively doing what we can. This is actively doing what we can plus making it our personal responsibility to do that. To liberate everyone from suffering. I myself alone am going to liberate everyone from suffering. Exactly. If we look at our current state, exactly true. But if we achieve enlightenment, it's not.
If we achieve enlightenment.
So that's why the only way we can implement that is if we strive for enlightenment. That's bodhicitta.
The enlightenment comes after.
Correct.
You are into the responsibility.
Right. So we develop this intention, this personal responsibility, and then we'll see, well, I can't do much with that now. How can I implement that is if I achieve enlightenment. So that's the next step. Then we would aspire to enlightenment so that we can implement this.
You can
help to liberate. So how can we help to liberate others? Can we wave a magic wand?
No.
We can guide them. We can teach them, help them, support them. But as an enlightened person, you can appear in many places simultaneously, not just as one person. The Buddha may be manifesting as 20 people here right now. The historical Buddha may be appearing as 20 different people in this room right now. No, because this is an intention that goes on forever. Remember, the intention is to help liberate others from suffering. And so we enact that intention forever. So, like, for example, one of the six perfections is generosity. Yeah? The perfection of generosity is not that we've eliminated poverty. Is it? The perfection of generosity is that we have no resistance to giving. Because we can't wave a magic wand and put everyone into enlightenment, can we? It'd be good, but not possible.
So let's say, ideally, everybody gets enlightened.
We can all take a holiday then.
Yeah, so in the texts, they say we don't need to worry about that point. We just need to work as best we can towards that.
I'm trying to understand if I really have to believe in rebirth and in reincarnation.
For the first step?
No, in general, Yeah, to get to bodhicitta.
Sure.
In the beginning, from what you said and also from what I read, I thought you were about to say, you know, evolutionary, like we all came from the same place and we are all the same and all the mother, and therefore I remember the kindness of everyone.
Sure.
And I want to. Sure. And then also I can maybe achieve the bodhicitta in the perspective of life without believing in actual inclination.
That's what we're going to see in the second method. Mm. In the second method, there's not really this inbuilt need to have a belief in rebirth. But here, I mean, we could try and do that without a belief in rebirth, but I don't know, it may be a bit difficult. We could think that, well, we're living in an interdependent world, so, you know, we can receive benefit from everyone. In fact, one of the things we'll see later is, in terms of a teacher, what we can say is, everyone is our teacher. We can learn from everyone. So in that sense, we may be able to... That people are kind to us. In fact, in the Lojong system of teachings, one of the systems that Lama Ratisha brought to Tibet, one of the instructions there is to see difficult people as a holy teacher. Because actually, it's only difficult people who help us to develop patience. Nice people don't help us to develop patience. And there's a story actually about Lama Ratisha who came to Tibet. When he came to Tibet, he had an attendant with him. Maybe he was cooking, I'm not sure what he was doing. But this attendant was completely obnoxious, really nasty person, not very nice person. And the Tibetan said to Lama Ratisha, "Why did you bring him? Why didn't you bring a good, nice person?" He said, "He's my most holy teacher." So he specifically picked him so that he would test him about his patience. At our level, we don't need to do that.
It also brings me to the question, if I can... Well, maybe not according to the Mahayana and their terminology for being enlightened, but I think like we can be enlightened also without the Mahayana, and it's maybe a question, and without being believing in rebirth and everything, like just to somehow have this will to...
Yeah. So the question is, do you have to be a Buddhist to achieve enlightenment? Absolutely not. But the Buddhist assertion is to achieve enlightenment, you need bodhicitta, or whatever you want to call it, the same aspiration, plus a direct realization of nature of reality. If you have those two, you can achieve enlightenment, whatever system you're in. That's the Buddhist assertion. Of course, that may be false, but that's the Buddhist assertion. Patience,
or generosity, whatever.
Sure.
Aren't we kind of dependent on everybody else to be in dukkha as well? Aren't we dependent on all of us suffering together? So someone would need, so I would have the opportunity to give or not give?
And that's how we can see everyone as our holy teacher, because they can provide that opportunity for us.
But in order for me to go on the path, I need people around me to go on the path as well. Because
people around you to go on the path.
If everyone would be enlightened, nobody would need anything from me.
Right, and that's the goal, is to have that final goal, and then good, very good.
How would I practice? It's
well, like you don't need to practice anymore.
It seems to be that I need to get somebody else to suffer as well, so I can practice.
Well, that's the reality, isn't it? Everyone's suffering. And so the idea of practice is so that everyone can go beyond suffering. That's the whole idea of practice, is so that everyone can go beyond suffering.
It seems like I kind of need them to suffer as well, so I can practice.
It can help you, but I think not necessary, because we can draw on our own past suffering as a vehicle for us to move forward as well. Because some people, what we'll see is that some practitioners at some point go into isolation and achieve enlightenment in that state. So it's not like we have to have suffering people around us all the time till we get to enlightenment, to achieve enlightenment. No.
Going back to the point about the teacher who came from India.
Atisha. The teacher being taken advantage of.
But your patience.
Oh, you mean it's too much for you?
It's just like what they say, that there's a near enemy. Poor patience. Like, can you be too patient? Can you be?
No.
Did you say for compassion before?
So remember, patience is not a behavior. Patience is not sitting there and doing nothing. Patience is a undisturbed mind in the face of a difficult situation. So we can never be too undisturbed, too calm.
Okay. So it doesn't mean accepting, it means
no, no, no.
Being undisturbed.
I mean, of course, I assume that Lama Ratisha was, that person was helping Lama Ratisha to be patient, but then also Lama Ratisha had an opportunity to help that person to overcome his bad habits, I imagine. You know, it wasn't like Lama Ratisha is saying, stay as a nasty person because I need you to be that. I don't think that's the case.
If we assume that the objects of becoming a Buddha aren't
The what, sorry?
The arts of becoming a Buddha. The arts, like
art.
Are not good.
Odds. I thought you said art. Odds. Yeah.
What does that mean? Kind of, what's the implication for your kind of run-of-the-mill practitioner of the efficacy of this sort of work? So is it assumed that there are benefits before you get to...
Oh, absolutely. There's benefit from day one.
I mean, for you personally... Like,
day one.
If there's a risk in falling into kind of some sort of self-indulgence of kind of meditating alone, or is the assumption
I mean, in any spiritual endeavor, there's a chance of falling into self-indulgence and going astray. Of course, of course. And that's why, as we're going to see day after tomorrow, the importance of having a qualified teacher to help us avoid doing that. And a qualified teacher can also help us avoid wasting our time. Because as we're starting to see here, there's a huge number of different practices. And then the question is, well, which one should I do and what order? And we don't know.
I mean specifically for meditating on loving kindness.
Sure.
If you're not a Buddha, and so you, there's no direct causal effect in terms of how that's helping people, right? Because that's what you're
what
saying.
What do you mean there's no causal effect?
Just sort of sitting on your own meditating on loving kindness
right.
Isn't actually helping anyone.
Yes and no. Yes and no, directly.
Yeah, that's right.
Sorry?
It's changing you. And then
right.
But then the assumption is you're going to
have. But I mean, of course, I don't think you're sitting on your meditation cushion for years on end.
That's what I wanted to ask.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, it's the same. The analogy I use here is like, you know, often people, you know, who come look from outside and see some Buddhist person doing a year's retreat or something, they say, or you're just escaping from society and you're not helping. The analogy I use is like, if we want to go out and heal the world, is it better to run out and do something, or is it better to go off to medical school for 6 years to become a doctor and then go out? Which is better? I mean, for some people, being a doctor, for some others, maybe not. So we as an individual have to see how can we be most effective in helping others. And in any person, there are two aspects. There's inner development and outward expression. And the balance will depend on the individual. Sometimes we need to withdraw to develop ourselves, otherwise we're not effective in helping others. But we need both. We need to develop ourselves and help others. How to achieve that balance most effectively, again, qualified teacher can be very helpful.
Yeah.
I would say the vast majority of us probably... a 3 or 5 year retreat is probably not going to be a good balance. Maybe there's a few in this room where that would be the best thing to do, to go off for 3 years and meditate, maybe. A qualified teacher can help us to make those decisions on how much time and when to develop ourselves and how much time and when to go out and help. And in fact, sometimes the Dalai Lama, when he's talking to the Tibetan community, including monks and nuns, gets a little bit critical and harsh of them and say, you need to be more like our Christian brothers and sisters who go out and help in the world, social help. And so he sometimes gets a bit critical of the Tibetans because of this.
Yeah, I guess I just had this image of people like, you know, spending years on a mountainside in a hut on their own.
And unfortunately, sometimes people have this romantic view. They think, oh, I'm just going to go and meditate for 3 years and then I'll be enlightened. And then, of course, people give up everything. They run off, and 2 weeks later, they're running back. Really. Not even 2 weeks. Because they're not ready for it. They're not ready for it. It's not helpful.
I have a comment on that. I mean, I read kind of article if someone is enlightened or someone has a higher consciousness, the entire being get a good influence from the person who developed the
absolutely
consciousness.
I mean,
it's not like doing social work, but
sure.
Just consciousness
as well. I mean, also when the question there about if we're meditating, is there any direct benefit? Well, of course, at the simple level, the benefit is when you get off your cushion and you go out, you're more kind. That's the benefit for others. But also here, as at a subtle level, you doing that, you can have a direct impact on others. We're going to see that a little bit now in the next presentation. Due to the interconnected nature of reality, is that, for example, if you have particularly some connection with someone and they're having some sort of suffering or something that they need to overcome, and you can do this practice that we're going to talk about this afternoon, and it's only a mental practice, and you imagine taking their suffering and giving them happiness, you know, then of course the direct benefit is you by developing avankashan, and then you go out and help. But at a subtle level, even if that person's on the other side of the planet, you can have a direct positive impact on their mind. And there's some scientific evidence to support this. So you can, at a subtle level, have that direct impact. And we can sort of notice that a little bit when someone who's really developed these qualities, when they walk into the room, without them saying anything, they can have a very positive impact. Like Dalai Lama, many people, and even people who are sort of a little bit sort of very skeptical of this, I've seen this so many times, people who are sort of, what's this religious rubbish, you know? And I've seen like very strong, particularly men who have this attitude, sort of go into tears when they see the Dalai Lama because of that impact from, and he doesn't say anything. He doesn't do anything. They just see him and that's what happens. Okay, second method. This is a five-step method, and in ancient India and Tibet, this method was actually considered too difficult for the average person. So it was a little bit a secret instruction, only given to those who could really appreciate it. But I think in our modern society, this method, I think, for many of us, is a much more powerful method. And there are reasons for that which will become obvious. A long title, it's called Equalizing and Exchanging Self with Others. Five steps. The first step is equalizing self with others. And this is very similar to this idea of equanimity. In here, in particular, it's more to do with the fact that we put our happiness above the happiness of everyone else. Equanimity, of course, is more about attachment, apathy, aversion. Here, it's about seeing ourselves as more important than anyone else. So, equalizing self with others is really about understanding that we're all equal in wanting to be happy, wanting to be free of suffering. Our happiness is no more important than the happiness of anyone else. So this is the first step, is really to try to appreciate that. Then the next two steps sort of go together. The second step is to reflect on the disadvantages of self-cherishing. And self-cherishing is the selfish, self-centered attitude that sees my happiness as more important than the happiness of anyone else. And again, superficially, it seems like selfish motivation is our friend, bringing us happiness. And our modern society very much promotes this attitude. Look after number one, you're the most important. But actually, if we look closely, self-cherishing is our worst enemy, only bringing suffering. So let's have a look at how self-cherishing just brings suffering. with this self-cherishing, we tend to have an obsessive self-focus. Me, 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 me. And we often become obsessed about my suffering and my happiness. And if we become obsessed about my suffering, and together with that, again, we often feel the source of suffering is out there, then what happens, of course, is with strong self-cherishing, we tend to develop a lot of fear and anxiety about the world. Everything out there is a potential threat to my happiness and could cause me suffering. Even my best friend is a potential threat. So I better be on guard. So it's never restful. It's very stressful, that state of mind. And this was very much highlighted in a medical study they did a few years ago. It was a very wide range medical study. I think it was either done in the US or Europe. But they studied a lot of people. And the result of this medical study was people who use the words I, me, and mine a lot have a 35% greater risk of heart attack. So it seems like it's quite stressful, this sort of me, me, me thing. And of course, to protect ourselves from all these potential threats out there, what do? We build a big wall around ourselves to protect ourselves. But of course, all that does is it cuts us off from everything. So we feel completely isolated and lonely. So self-cherishing often breeds a lot of loneliness. And then, of course, on the opposite side, if we're obsessed about me and my happiness, and that happiness seems to be coming from out there, we develop a lot of craving for things. And of course, if we don't get those, we have a lot of frustration. And even if we get them, they never satisfy us. We have a lot of dissatisfaction, and then we end up craving more, more, more. And then often what can happen is, because nothing's really satisfying us, we fall into depression. It's hopeless. I can never be happy. Also, of course, with this self-cherishing attitude, we have an exaggerated sense of self-importance. You know, I'm the most important person on the planet. Everything revolves around me. And then from that, often we show a lack of consideration and respect for others. And then, of course, anyone who seems to have more than us, we get very jealous. And then also we become very competitive with everyone, trying to outdo others and put them down so we get to the top of the pile. And then, of course, anyone who we see who seems to be at a lower level than ourselves, often we become very arrogant and dismissive of them. And then, of course, because my happiness is the most important thing, we'll even harm others who stand in the way of our happiness. And generally, if we harm others in the pursuit of our happiness, they harm us back. And then, of course, as I already mentioned this morning, particularly with this self-cherishing attitude, our perspective in everything we do is first person. How is this situation affecting me? That's our normal perspective. And then, of course, anyone who seems to be supporting my happiness, friend. Anyone who doesn't affect my happiness in any way, stranger. Anyone who seems to be interfering with my happiness, enemy. So again, we end up with attachment to friends, apathy to strangers, and hostility, anger, and hatred to difficult people. And then, when it comes to cultivating loving kindness and compassion, disaster. Loving kindness and compassion to friends? Yes, but only if they keep helping me and supporting me. Otherwise, no. Loving kindness and compassion to strangers? Couldn't care less what happens to them, so no. Loving kindness and compassion to the enemy? No way. In fact, I hope they suffer. They deserve to suffer. So we can't develop loving kindness and compassion purely to anyone with a selfish attitude. So if we reflect on that, disadvantages of self-cherishing, then we'll understand that self-cherishing actually is our worst enemy. Even though it seems to be our best friend bringing us happiness, it's only bringing us misery and suffering. And then together with that, we can reflect on the opposite. And that is to reflect on the advantages of cherishing others. And of course, the advantages of cherishing others are just the exact opposite of self, the disadvantages of self-cherishing. So if we are cherishing others, we won't have this obsessive self-focus. So we won't have this obsession about me and my happiness, me and my suffering, which means we won't be developing all this fear and anxiety about the world. We won't be building a big wall to protect ourselves. Rather, because we're cherishing others, we'll be more connected with others. We won't have any loneliness because we'll feel connected with others. And of course, we're not obsessed about me and my happiness. It means we won't have all this craving, frustration, and disappointment. And then, of course, we're not going to have an exaggerated sense of self-importance. It means we will show consideration and respect for others. And if someone has more than us, we'll rejoice, we'll be happy. We won't be competitive with others, trying to put them down. We'll try to help them as much as we can. Particularly if they're at a lower level, we'll try and help them if they have some disadvantages. And also, of course, we will not deliberately harm others in the pursuit of our happiness. And then we'll be able to develop loving kindness and compassion towards everyone. Now, we need to be a little bit careful here in cherishing others. Because sometimes people do cherish others and they have a lot of problems. And I've already mentioned, I think, at least one of the reasons that's the case earlier. But to re-emphasize that point, I'll use a concrete example. A couple of years ago, there was a Danish school teacher, and he was teaching primary school children. And he heard about this idea of cherishing others, and he thought this was a fantastic idea. So he went back to Denmark to implement cherishing his children in the class. And the result was a disaster. The children went crazy in class, and it was a mess. And then he really had a dilemma, because he really felt cherishing others was the right thing to do, but the result was a mess. But then slowly he understood cherishing others doesn't mean sit there, smile and say nice things. Cherishing others, of course, means to benefit others, to help others. So, of course, if the child is misbehaving, we need to discipline them. So that's what he understood, that what was missing was wisdom. So with cherishing others, of course, we need to apply wisdom. Otherwise, this will happen. People will take advantage of us and it will be a disaster. And of course, with cherishing others, we need to overcome self-cherishing. Another thing important is we need to look after ourselves. Because otherwise, often people who then really try to implement cherishing others sometimes feel if they do anything for themselves, they're being selfish. Not true. If we don't look after ourselves, if we don't have time to rest and look after ourselves, how are we going to cherish others? So whether or not doing something for yourself is selfish is motivation. If your motivation is, I'm resting, I'm doing this for myself so that I can better help others, then that's what we need to do. So we need to keep that in mind, that we need to look after ourselves, and that when cherishing others, we always need to apply wisdom. Otherwise, people will take advantage of us. So those two go together. So maybe any questions so far?
How is it possible that somebody is taking advantage of you or misusing you in some way? To be loving kindness towards them.
So loving kindness, remember, doesn't mean smile and say nice things. Although often when we're implementing, we probably will have a smile, but that's not the meaning of loving kindness. Remember, loving kindness is the wish for them to have happiness. And compassion is the wish for them to be free of suffering and its causes. So if that person is taking advantage of you, that you're encouraging their mental afflictions. So if you allow them to take advantage of you, that is not compassion. That is the opposite of compassion, because you're encouraging them to behave badly. So wisdom says, to be compassionate, we need to stop that person from behaving badly without attacking the person. If we do cognitive fusion, we're simply going to get angry at the person, and of course that's not compassion. So with compassion, we can be very forceful about their behaviour. We can say, that behaviour, what you're doing is completely unacceptable, I will not accept that behaviour. And you can do that with a compassionate attitude. And if you really do that with a compassionate attitude and the person is a little bit open, they can sense that. They can sense that you care for them. And they may listen to what you have to say. No guarantee, but it's a chance. In fact, that reminds me of another thing related to this, is when I talked about the cognitive fusion and how it leads to problems. We do this cognitive fusion in our modern society in many areas, particularly in our judicial system. If someone has created a crime, what do? We punish people, don't we? We punish people, normally, in our penal system. And statistics show if we punish people, they come out worse. They're a bigger cost to society. So even financially, punishing people is counterproductive. Rather, more progressive societies that punish crimes and try to rehabilitate people have a much better outcome. In fact, I saw a program on TV recently where they have this system in Norway a lot. And in fact, they were interviewing this guard who worked at a maximum security prison. Maximum security for the big offenders. In this maximum security prison in Norway, there were no bars on the windows. No bars. No one had tried to escape because the prisoners saw that they were being cared for. So this, I think, is what we need to do. We can have a caring attitude and be very forceful about that behaviour. And then people will pick that up and they may listen then. And then we can help them.
You mentioned before that if you want a human team member to take care of yourself, if you're rationalizing it as I'm doing this so that I can help others, but doesn't create a loophole that you can something you can use to rationalize everything. Well, I need to eat this much of food in order to help everyone else. I need to have this huge, 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 huge house, because then maybe someday I'll have tons of puppies in the future.
Of course we can delude ourselves with anything, of course. Absolutely. Absolutely. So therefore, if we implement these various practices, we can come to clearly see that we're deluding ourselves. And then secondly, we can start to do something about that, of course. I mean, of course there's a lot of potential in any spiritual practice to delude ourselves and go astray. And again, particularly if we have a personal teacher and we start to do that, they'll probably slap us around a little bit and say, you know, come on, sort yourself out, you're deluding yourself. So that's another reason why a personal teacher can be very helpful, because sometimes we don't realise we're deluding ourselves, and before we know it, we've gone way astray. That's why not only personal teacher, but the idea of spiritual community can be very helpful, because often the last person to see something is ourself. Others around us, our wrong way of behaving, often to the people around us is very obvious. And often the last person to realise is ourself, because we're deluded. So that's why other people around us who are trying to do something similar, plus a teacher, can really highlight, you know, hey, you're really going astray here. So that can be very helpful.
So a following question for that we were talking today in discussion group regarding Buddha's family and how he left basically his family in order to help others.
He came back, and one of his first disciples was his wife.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we were discussing understanding how this family goes into the practicing this. If you're not with your family, you're not taking care of them, but you're helping others.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, on the earlier question, this balance of inner development and outward expression, part of that, of course, is we need to look at our responsibilities. If we have family responsibilities, it would be completely irresponsible to abandon them. So that, of course, has got to be part of it.
About this topic, I understand, this one and the one before about seven causes of effect are part of five...
are helping us to cultivate bodhicitta, the aspiration for enlightenment to benefit others.
Okay,
so both of these are methods to help us to develop that state of mind, bodhicitta.
But what about people who have jobs, get paid to get to people? What about, you know, people who are in the army?
Yeah.
Or a detective?
Sure. Again, you know, we have to look at ourselves, what we're doing. And I think there's a difference to go in some army with the motivation of then protecting our society, our country, versus going in an army in the hope that we can invade another country and kill people. So, you know, even there's a big range of difference of motivation. So, of course, if we go into anything wanting to kill people, I mean, I think this is not so good.
But they're going there to protect their own country.
Sure, and we need to protect ourselves. So if someone is threatening you, Buddhism doesn't say let them do what they want. No, that would be irresponsible for you and for that person.
So basically retaliate.
Well, not retaliate, you defend yourself. But again, if you get angry, often we overreact and then it gets really out of control. So of course we need to defend ourselves. Of course, absolutely. Otherwise we're not helping ourselves or the other person.
But in that case, then that's fine. They can practice Buddhism.
Well, I mean, again, if it gets to the point where that's the only option, then that's the thing we have to consider. But of course, often that's not, you know, when it gets to that point, we can often usually solve the situation well before it gets to that point in any confrontation,
but
usually.
Doesn't, for example, the Dalai Lama he doesn't support any of the, there are like certain factions that promote
violence yeah,
against
sure.
the Chinese, but doesn't
sure.
he...
Yeah, and violence is wishing to hurt them.
Yeah,
and that's not going to help. Then you're as bad as the perpetrator. I mean, there's a difference between violence, wishing to hurt people, and using forceful behaviour to get your message across. It's very different. Okay. On the basis of these two, then we'll understand that this self-cherishing is very harmful to us, and that cherishing others is a source of happiness. And so the fourth step is then wishing to implement this. I mean, of course, non-violence you can understand that in many different ways. But non-violence in sitting there and letting people beat you up, I'm not sure that Buddhism would say that's a good approach. The fourth one is exchanging self with others. And so what this is in daily life, whenever we see a selfish motivation arising, then as best we can to exchange that with an attitude of cherishing others. And here, I think I already mentioned earlier in the course, but I'll mention again, is sometimes then people interpret this to mean, if I'm going to do something good and I notice a selfish motivation, I won't do it. I think if we do that, it's going to be difficult to begin to do anything for others. Because generally, when we help others, at some level, there will be some selfishness there. So rather than stopping doing good actions because we have a selfish motivation, we need to notice the selfish motivation, and try to reduce that as much as possible, and try to replace that as much as possible with an attitude of cherishing others, and then still do the good behaviour, even if there still is some selfishness involved. Because if we continue to do that, what we're going to notice over time is that the joy we receive from merely helping others for their sake will far outweigh any joy that we will get from getting something in return. So this is the fourth one, and there's two quotes here that I particularly like, relevant to the fourth one. And the first is, and probably some of you have heard this quote, it's very well known, it says, "When I am hungry, give me someone that I can feed. And when I am thirsty, give me someone who needs a drink. When I am cold, give me someone to keep warm. And when I grieve, give me someone to console." So this is from Mother Teresa, who I think she was pretty good at this exchanging self with others. And then there's another short quote that is, I think, quite nice. It is, "Only a life lived for others is a life worthwhile. Only a life lived for others is a life worthwhile." And this comes from Albert Einstein. So maybe he was onto something there. Okay, so that's the fourth point. And then the fifth point in the process is an actual meditation practice to help us to reduce and eliminate self-cherishing, to increase cherishing others, to transform our attachment and aversion into loving kindness and compassion. And that is a practice called Tonglen, which is a Tibetan word, which means giving and taking. And what we're doing in this practice is we're imagining taking suffering from someone else, and we're imagining giving our happiness away to them. And this is a very powerful method, because the last thing that self-cherishing would want to do would be to take on any suffering from anybody. And the last thing self-cherishing would want to do would be to give away any happiness to anyone. So developing that aspiration to take the suffering and give happiness is really reducing our self-cherishing and increasing cherishing others, increasing loving kindness and compassion. Now, how we do this practice is, again, we do this in stages, like loving kindness and compassion as we saw this morning. So with this practice, again, generally you start with friend, someone close to you, because it's more easy to take their suffering and give them happiness. Then we move out to strangers, and then when we're comfortable, out to more difficult people, and then toward everyone. But again, I think at a beginning point, we need to begin with ourselves. And in this practice, we use visualization to help the practice. So what we do is, and we'll use the example of a friend. So we imagine a friend who's got some sort of suffering. We imagine them in front of us. And then, of course, we develop the wish that they be free of that suffering. So that's compassion. Then we imagine their suffering as black smoke in their body. And then, conjoined with the breath, we imagine breathing that black smoke out of their body. This is the sort of the willingness to take their suffering from them. Now, the next part, there's two options on what we can do. The traditional option, which I think for some of us may cause a bit of difficulty, and I'll explain why, is the traditional way it's described, is then you imagine your selfish attitude as a small rock, black rock, in the centre of your chest. And then when you're breathing, taking the smoke out of their body, symbolizing taking their suffering away from them, you imagine that the black smoke comes in, goes down, touches the black rock, and they're both destroyed. Because it's our willingness to take their suffering which destroys self-cherishing. And that's symbolized in this way. Now, the reason why I think that in our modern society that approach sometimes can be problematic is, again, cognitive fusion. Again, in our modern society, we're identifying with negative, with cognitive fusion. So rather than doing this correctly, sometimes what people do is they take on the smoke and identify with that and punish themselves. So this is cognitive fusion, so this is not the practice. Again, we imagine taking the smoke and using that to destroy the self-cherishing mind, not to punish ourselves. The other option, and maybe this is the option that Renato is going to introduce in this meditation a little bit later, is that we can, instead of the black rock here, we can symbolize the purity of our mind. We said that the mental afflictions are simply covering the surface of the mind. That beneath the mental afflictions, that the mental afflictions are not part of the nature of the mind, that the mind by nature is naturally pure. And this purity of mind, sometimes in Buddhism, is called Buddha nature. It's our potential to achieve enlightenment. Mm-hmm. Because if the nature of our mind was mental afflictions, we'd be stuck. But because it's not, because it's actually pure by nature, therefore we can eliminate the mental afflictions and achieve enlightenment. So that purity of mind is called Buddha nature. So instead of the black rock, we can symbolize this purity of mind as a small white light here. And then when we breathe in the smoke, imagine that it dissolves there. Because this white light is also symbolizing our inner wisdom. And it's our inner wisdom that dissolves suffering. So we can imagine that. So they're the two options. So that's the first part, the taking, which is the compassion. Then the second part is then we generate the wish for them to be happy, which is loving kindness. And then in both approaches, we have that white light at the center of our heart, and then imagine that sending out the white light to them, and imagine that that light transforms into everything they need to be happy. So that is loving kindness, sending them happiness. So this is the process that we do in this Tonglen meditation. We can join it with the breath. And again, you'll be practicing this with Renato, I think, day after tomorrow, maybe. Anyway, I think a couple of times we're going to do that practice. Now, in this practice, one or two more things. One is that in this practice, the most important thing is not whether or not you have a nice visualization and you're having nice looking smoke and nice looking light and so forth, because we can do that and it can become very mechanical. You know, smoke, light, okay, good. And nothing changes. The most important point with this practice is the wish to take their happiness and the wish to give them, to take their suffering and the wish to give them happiness. That's the key element. Not whether or not the visualization is clear. We don't even have to do visualization. We don't have to do any smoke or light or whatever. The key point is the wish to take that suffering, the wish to give them happiness. And then that is loving kindness and compassion, cherishing others. So that's the key element in this practice. Now, one or two more things and then maybe some questions. Remember, when we're taking, where compassion is suffering and its causes, not just suffering. So also, this practice is very good to do with people who have a lot of mental afflictions. We can imagine their mental afflictions as black smoke taking their mental afflictions. Similarly with us, we can do this practice with ourselves, with any suffering or mental afflictions, dissolving it into that light. And again, you'll go through the process, the practice, a couple of times with Renato in the coming days. Now, when this practice is explained, often one or two doubts come up about the practice. And one doubt is, if I'm doing this with someone who's got some sort of illness, will I get sick? Will I get that illness? And of course the answer is no, because this is a visualization. But then people go, well, if I can't actually take their suffering from them, what's the point of this practice? And as we saw briefly earlier, the main beneficiary of this practice is you yourself. Because this practice is about increasing loving kindness and compassion, decreasing self-cherishing. Which means that if we do this practice effectively, it means that when we get up into daily life, we're more likely to help people in a more pure way. We're more likely to help our friends in a pure way. Now, sometimes we help friends, but with our own agenda. I know what's best for you. You need to do like this. This is selfish. You know, I know best. Rather than doing it for their sake. So if we do this practice, we'll help our friends in a more pure way, less selfish, and we're going to start to help people who we seem to ignore now. And even difficult people, rather than get angry at them, we'll try and help them. Now, also, as I mentioned briefly before, there can be a very subtle, direct, positive impact on the other person. If we're doing this for a person, particularly if we have a connection with them, even if they're on the other side of the planet, if we really wish to take their suffering, give them happiness, and some scientific experiments support this, is that we can have a very subtle, direct, positive impact on their mind due to the interconnected nature of reality. And also, and this is a little bit actually unfortunate, is that modern studies show that if we pray for people who are sick and we tell them we're praying for them, on average, that they have a net negative impact, slight negative impact. And I think it is because in our modern society, oh, someone's praying for me, you know, whatever the reason. And this is very unfortunate that in our modern society, when people hear that they're praying, someone's praying for them, that on average, that has a negative impact on the person. I mean, I find that very tragic. But apparently studies show this. So therefore, if you're doing this practice for that reason, and also another reason, it would be best to do it anonymously. Don't tell the person. Because also if you tell them, it may boost the self-cherishing. You know, I'm doing this practice for you, you know. Remember that. I'm doing it for you. So again, probably better for that reason as well, do it anonymously. Okay, any questions about this practice or anything here?
We were talking earlier about the first story of the
vegetables, yeah.
Yeah, and you said friends, strangers, and enemies.
Yeah.
First of all, ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So if we feel that we are suffering first in ourselves, we need to deal with it. Don't we need to first do this practice on...
Yeah.
We start to take suffering from others.
Exactly. And I think I mentioned that briefly, is that with this Tonglen practice, it's also very helpful to start with ourselves, particularly if we have guilt, low self-esteem, self-hatred. Because otherwise we won't be able to do it with others. So we really need to start with ourselves. And we can do this in a very practical way. I mean, this is a meditation practice, but it's something we can do throughout our daily life. For example, you know, we see someone who's got some obvious suffering, physical or mental. We can do this whole practice in one breath. On the in-breath, take the suffering. On the out-breath, give them happiness. So we can do this throughout the day. And the more we do it, then that means the more likely we are to actually help people when we have an opportunity to help them, rather than go, well, that's not my problem, you know, they do need to deal with it. That sort of attitude. And also, I think as I briefly mentioned a couple of days ago, is when we're suffering, often we go, oh, I'm suffering, oh, go away, go away, go away. And then, of course, it just magnifies. So if we have some suffering, we can, instead of doing that, we can do this practice of taking the suffering, giving happiness. And as I mentioned, what we can do is, if we've got some sort of suffering, and I used the example before, the migraine headache, is go take the migraine headache on from everyone else and then give them happiness. So we can use that suffering not to develop aversion and have more suffering, but to use that difficult situation to develop compassion.
So it also helps me to release all my suffering.
Exactly.
About suffering.
Exactly. It does both. It stops you from magnifying your suffering, and it helps you to develop compassion for others at the same time. So win-win-win. Also, what can be very helpful here in daily life is when we're about to face a difficult situation. Maybe we're going to meet someone at work and we anticipate it's not going to go well. So usually when that's the case, we go into it defensive, on the defensive. And then they say some little thing and then we react. So to stop that, as we're physically walking towards them, we can do this practice. Take their suffering, give them happiness. And then we won't be on the defensive. And then more likely, when we open our mouth, we'll say something constructive rather than defensive. So this can be helpful also for these difficult situations. There's one thing more I wanted to add, but I forgot, so I'll leave it there.
In the taking and giving, are we supposed to actually imagine taking someone's sickness and giving it to us?
No.
Even if we're not getting sick. Because that sounds actually, because in real life, if you do help someone or if you give something, you give up something. So
right.
That's actually what should be happening.
Yeah. So again, as I mentioned before, that's what we don't want to do. We're not taking a sickness and punishing ourselves. We want to take this suffering away, and that wish to take it away destroys our self-cherishing. So we can symbolize that by destroying the rock of self-cherishing, or we can dissolve it into the light, symbolizing that it's the inner wisdom that dissolves suffering. So holding on to it, of course, is cognitive fusion. And that's what we do now. We hold on to negative things and punish ourselves. So we don't want to do that, and that's a wrong approach. So that's what we want to do in this situation. Yeah.
Don't you think sometimes it's important to ask permission to the people who is suffering to do this practice? This is the first question. And the second, why is that the stone?
Why ask permission? Remember, the main beneficiary of this practice is you. You're the one who's benefiting most.
Yes, but it is like a ritual to ask permission for the person in a very bad condition.
Well, we're not sort of doing some physical intervention. I mean, if you're doing some physical intervention, Reiki or something, or then yes, you probably need to ask permission. But this is a mental exercise. So I think that, and again, I think it's best to do it anonymously. Not to tell the person. And the second question?
Why the stone is black?
Because black is symbolizing negativity. Self-cherishing leads to negativity. That's why. That's the symbolism.
I'm not sure it's true. I heard stories about the situation in Tibet that monks with fire on them committed suicide.
Yeah, well, I think the Dalai Lama doesn't agree with that. I mean, of course, it's up to the individual what method they use, but the Dalai Lama certainly doesn't agree with that approach.
What's that approach?
Self-immolation for the Tibetan cause.
Yeah,
it's about the situation in Tibet. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah, sorry.
In my own small life, modest life.
Sure. Sure. Absolutely.
It's okay.
It's your life. It's your life. There's no one There's no one saying you have to do anything. I mean, it's up to you what you want to do with your life. Absolutely.
Can you go in the reason of everyone to achieve enlightenment? Like, Judaism, the goal is that everyone will be religious, and then Mashiach will come, and then everything will be peaceful.
Yeah, I mean, again, the goal is to for everyone eventually to achieve enlightenment, but it's we don't really need to worry about that sort of eventuality now, because we just work on ourselves. But again, you know, it's up to you what you want to do with your life. So there's no one saying you have to do anything. It's completely your own choice. It could be, and that would be much better selfishness than not doing anything for others. And then what you... Of course, you can become attached to that joy, of course, but then that the more you can let go of it, the more joy you will have. I mean, it's up to you. I mean, if you want to crave that joy, that's okay. At least you're helping others and you're getting some joy out of it, and the more we can let go of that craving, the more joy we will get for the sake of just helping others, but it's okay.
I found it of itself, we are learning those things. Because this is very natural thing.
It's what?
Natural.
Natural.
Yeah, natural. As a human, for me, personally.
Natural, natural.
We are all, should have those things naturally. We don't need to learn.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, that's right, is when you use the word natural, and this is what we're going to see tomorrow when we talk about the Vipassana practice, particularly the emptiness practice, is that if we can come to realize reality and eliminate mental afflictions, the natural expression of that is loving kindness and compassion. Yes, according to Buddhism, that is the natural expression of the mind. But unfortunately, even though it's the natural expression, it's blocked. It's covered by mental afflictions.
Yeah, so
it can't express itself. So therefore, we have to help it to express itself. But eventually, it will become spontaneous. Yes?
So those things is for modern society or Buddha
also? Or even way, yeah, the whole, yeah, everybody.
He was a taught this.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not just modern society. I mean, I think people were also selfish before, although maybe more selfish now than in earlier times. In fact, it was interesting, and then we have to stop, we run out of time. It's interesting, you know, I talked a little bit about this epidemic of guilt and low self-esteem. There's no word in Tibetan for guilt. It doesn't exist in the Tibetan language. And when Tibetan Buddhism first came to the West, and then Westerners went to lamas to sort of say, what can I do about my guilt and low self-esteem? The translator had all sorts of problems to explain what the problem was. They couldn't understand. Couldn't understand. And also, early on, Dalai Lama's part of what's called Mind and Life. It's an organization where scientists and psychologists come together with Dalai Lama and other Buddhist practitioners to try and get some common understandings. And one early on, there was one of these meetings where it was, I think, mainly psychologists, and someone talked about low self-esteem. And the Dalai Lama said, oh, no, I don't think that's possible. And then the person, these are all sort of professionals, asked everyone in the room, how many of you suffer low self-esteem? And most of them put their hand up, and the Dalai Lama was quite shocked. But now, of course, he's not shocked, he knows. But so this phenomenon of guilt and low self-esteem, I think, is a very much a modern invention. But I think now, of course, Tibetans are probably also suffering a lot of guilt and low self-esteem as well. So, but it seems like that wasn't such a big issue before.
So the difference between guilt and regret is that one?
Well, guilt, like low self-esteem, is this cognitive fusion, identifying with our negative aspects. Okay, let's stop there. We've run out of time. So tomorrow, finally, We're going to talk about the nature of reality.
Yeah.
Let's see if we can make some sense of it. To read about that, page 13 and 14 in your book. And then also, if we have time tomorrow afternoon, on page 15, there's a presentation called The Five Paths. So we'll try and cover that in the afternoon if we get time. So that's the topic for tomorrow. Meditation now. With Renato, you're going to, in this session, next session, work with equanimity to really cultivate that equal attitude towards others. And then this evening, you're going to do a meditation on empathetic joy. Very nice meditation and very much needed in our modern society. So that's this evening. So let's have a break. And Renato, I'll see you at 5:30. I'll see you at 9 o'clock tomorrow.